gorgeous day. What a lovely day. This is brilliant.
It's a beautiful day.
Spring has sprung.
If only Mike were here.
Well, I was just going to say, it'd be lovely if Mike were here to help us enjoy it, but instead he's slumming it in the biggest beer garden in Europe.
Which I think is where he must be right now.
Yeah, we did expect him, but the teleporter hasn't flickered into life. We've not received an owl or a raven from him.
And Nick Feach was supposed to be coming as well, but it looks like Mark Shuttleworth made a load of announcements yesterday and he's just too busy doing real work.
You know who your real friends are, don't you? We're here for episode 9, season 2 of Linux Voice, the podcast. I'm Andrew Gregory.
I'm Ben Everard.
And I'm Graham Morrison.
And in this fun-packed episode, we have news, lots of news.
Plenty of news.
We have, at long last, a neuron from Phil the Sheep. And we've got some finds of the fortnight, and a vocalise your neurons.
And amazing vocalise your neurons.
Yeah, really extensive, deep voice of the neurons. it's voice of the masses, isn't it? Not vocalise your neurons. Sorry, I'm a bit, I don't really know where I am anymore.
Andrew has just driven 200 miles.
Squillion miles. Which to our Australian listeners, we'll see. Get on with it. Stop being so weak. And in that spirit of non-weakness, here's Ben Everard.
Okay, the non-weak news this 2 weeks is it starts off with news from our dear leader.
David Cameron.
Our other dear leader.
Clegg.
Nigel Farage.
Linus Torvalds.
Hey. Oh, yes.
That dear leader.
Him.
Yes. He's received IEEE Computer Society Computer Pioneer Award.
Wow.
IEEE. Is this
the Institute of Electrons? The Institute of Electrical and Electronic Engineers, I think.
Wow. Nothing to do with Libyans.
They may have members in Libya, I don't know. I'm not happy saying they're nothing to do with Libyans, but the majority of them aren't anything to do with Libya.
That would be quite funny if there was a Tripoli group in Tripoli.
Who knows? Well, probably someone. But anyway, this award is there to recognise the vision of those whose efforts resulted in the creation and continued vitality of the computer industry, apparently. And Linus, I sort of had a look at them, and there are a lot of old people, and he's like the youngest, by the looks of it, to have received it. So it's sort of, it's moved on from, they say, to result in the creation of the computer industry. And they're sort of recognising him for sort of pushing it forwards. Obviously, Linux is a big one, and I know a lot of comments online have pointed out that Git is actually another huge contribution. Oh. I mean, it's really, in their words, it's really revitalised the sort of hosting space.
So he gets the award for both Linux and Git.
It's just an award for a person,
for being awesome.
Really. Yeah, for being awesome. I mean, they were both significant parts of it.
Yeah.
So well done, Linux.
Well done. Do we know how he feels about it?
Probably happy.
He's probably gone diving.
Yeah.
Probably, I've got to go pick up another award. Yeah.
There's no space on my trophy cabinet for all these awards. It's not a Nobel Prize, it doesn't matter anymore.
Git was only, I say only, it was 2005, wasn't it? It was after the BitKeeper.
That was right, thing. Yeah. Brilliant memory skills.
Andrew Trigil forked BitKeeper, which was the software sharing repository thing that had been in use previously by the Linux kernel, and the owners of BitKeeper had let the kernel developers use it on some sort of friendly terms,
Because it was proprietary software.
And then this chap came along and forked it, to which the owners of BitKeeper were understandably a bit miffed about.
Well, I think BitKeeper, this is a long time ago, but they were due to put some restriction on what constituted a core kernel developer to try and make other people pay for access to BitKeeper.
Oh, really?
So for that reason, I think Tridgell reverse engineered the protocol, and this is what got everybody angry.
And then didn't Linus do it in like a weekend or something? He's like, oh, sod this.
Wasn't he friends with the BitKeeper people? And, you know, wanted to keep it all amicable, and then it all reached some kind of head, and he was like, oh, okay. And Git was born.
Yeah.
But less than 10 years ago.
Yeah.
It'd be really hard to imagine free software without it now.
Well, I mean, there are the sort of roughly equivalent softwares, so.
But that's the biggest.
Yeah, probably. Though Mercurial is used pretty widely, and what are the other ones? I always remember.
Well, there was Subversion and CVS.
Yeah, those ones I remember using.
It did seem really weird at the time that the kernel was hosted on a proprietary versioning system.
Yeah,
I remember talking about it. I think it was even pre the other podcast, but.
Yeah, I know, because for a long time it didn't have any versioning, didn't it? It was just you emailed Linus Biff and he had it on his laptop somewhere, or probably desktop then. And
oh, well, congratulations.
Yeah.
Yes, well done. Well done, Linus.
Let's move on more. Let's stick with kernel news. Well, roughly kernel news. There's a privilege escalation bug in the kernel using the sudo tty terminal. Basically what this means is if you're one user and you're logged into a system, you can use this particular bug to get more privileges than you should have and run sort of various code in ways you shouldn't be allowed to. So it won't affect a lot of systems. It's a big one everyone's talking about is shared hosting. So if you should only be able to access a small part of the system, then you could use this to escalate that. So keep on top of that if you're hosting systems like that.
Lots of distributions have already updated, haven't they, to include patches for that?
Yeah.
Lots of stories about whether open source software is really secure, or you're better off having proprietary software and not knowing about the insecurities.
yeah, just use XP. they never have to patch bugs anymore. That's it. They've reached their zenith. Yeah.
There's a lot to be said for living in denial. You're a happier person.
Up until a point.
Yeah, up until the point where you die.
That's escalated quickly.
As Mike isn't here, I should remind you all that the surest way to online security is to use macOS.
Yes.
Does that have any privilege escalation bugs?
I don't know.
Does it have more than one privilege level?
I know it can't attach to the internet. It's the only way.
Let's have a look for more news in the archives. Ah!
Ben flips through the dusty Ben, archives.
Come down from that ladder, Ben.
He's got one of those green visor things on.
Actually, I'm just struggling to read my handwriting. LXQT 0.7 has been released. This is the new desktop environment that's caused by mashing together LXDE and Razer Q2. Basically, the two code bases, one in each hand, and just squeezed them together, and out popped LXQT.
Where do babies come from?
Roughly similar process. But you don't use your hands. it's a really interesting project, because one of the things that they've said is, you know, open source software, it's famous for its forks, you know, blah, 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 everything seems to split. This is hardly ever do two projects merge.
Yes.
And it'll be interesting to see how it goes, because they started off with very similar goals to create sort of a lightweight desktop, really. They're using different toolkits at the time. LXD was using GTK2, and obviously Razer Q2 was using Q2. LXD got a bit disillusioned with GTK3. They decided that wasn't the route they wanted to go down, and if they just used Q2, they'd have ended up almost identical to Razer Q2, so they've decided to combine their efforts.
So does that mean that there will be no separate LXDE or Razer Q2 after this?
Well, I doubt there'll be a separate Razer QT. I suspect LXD will continue, at least in some form, because it's so popular. Some people keep maintaining it, even if it doesn't get as actively developed. But they are pushing this as the future.
They're porting their application. This was actually my discovery, because I installed it on my Archbox. Razer QT was great anyway, but the combination of the extra tools that come with LXD, well, the file manager, and there's a few other things. There's things like the image viewer, which I'm not massively fussed about, but it's a really fast, quick environment, and it looks really good.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah.
I always like to stay one step behind the curve, so I've just moved to LXD. At least on my laptop. But anyway, we'll go on to that in Voice of the Masses.
Yeah.
More news for now. Let's have a look. The EU court has said we have the right to be forgotten. Well, to be honest, it seems to have got a bit confused over what the internet is. So it said we've all got this right to be forgotten, therefore Google has to delete irrelevant and outdated data. Not that much irrelevant and outdated data is actually held on Google. So there's sort of this confusion over what's deleting, what's just not returning in the search results. It appears what they're saying is Google, you have to be able to say to Google, I don't want you to return that in the search. And when people type your name in, it won't pop up in the search. But this is being wildly reported as Google have to delete stuff from the internet, which obviously Google can't really do.
No.
Except in the small proportion of stuff it's held on Google servers.
Something's a bit troubling about this, isn't there?
Well, I've been thinking about it. I genuinely think the right to privacy and the right to delete inaccurate and outdated data about yourself, there is some validity in that. Because imagine kids growing up nowadays, do you want the stuff that you type into Facebook when you're 14 to be popping up in Google searches when you're 40?
It's a profound question. It's dealing with the internet as it's become, that nobody expected it to become. I mean, I used to admire actually Google's pragmatism when it came to what the results that it returned. It's always fought hard for the fact that it purely is a search engine and that, you know, provides links to content that's already there. And in some ways, I think that that's the right approach. You know, if there's happens to be a PDF about your mortgage going into arrears and it's publicly available and Google happens to search it and it's there in the cache, then, you know, there's a legitimacy to that, even if you'd find it uncomfortable. But at the same time, as I think we were just talking about this before, as in fact you were talking about Eric Schmidt's book about the future.
Yeah.
And if Google is in fact becoming the internet, then yes, I actually think I'd rather have some control. I'd rather have some right to take back something that I don't believe should be returned. Yes.
Yeah, I mean, I think we do have to acknowledge at this point that to all intents and purposes, Google do have a monopoly on search. That might not be legally true, but in reality, it is the truth. For the majority of people, what you find on the internet is what Google returns. And a lot of people have sort of talked about this, about censorship and blah, blah. I think it's much more akin to going ex-directory. There are certain cases where, I don't know if this is sort of a global thing, but in the UK you could have your name taken out of the phone book if you didn't want it there. For example, teachers often did it, etc. You still had a phone number, you just couldn't publicly search for it.
Yeah.
And I think this is a very similar case. You know, you're not necessarily forcing people to delete data, but you're saying it's not going to pop up on a trivial search.
But then you shouldn't, I suppose if it's data you don't have control over, but then it's up to you to not leave like a digital footprint for Google to search.
But what if it's not you that put it there?
Yeah.
What if 40 years ago someone wrote, Graham Morrison has a massive left toe, and you're now really embarrassed about
if that was all that was written, I would be all right there. Well, yeah, but then if it's somebody else saying something, if it happens to be somebody tweeting about, you know, UKIP policies, for example, you know, where's the line where you cross?
We have existing laws about things that are libelous or slanderous or defamatory.
It's true, but in the UK they're terrible.
That's also true.
But that's a wider problem. That's the real problem.
That's a different question, though.
It's true.
That's not about Google.
It's true, and I think this is another element of the law, because it's almost like saying it's an intermediate step for censorship. You're not stopping people saying something. You just, the irrelevant and outdated is obviously clearly up for interpretation by the courts and very loose.
Somebody made a good point about this. I read in some comments thread that it'll help. Of course, people like us will feel empowered by being able to do that, and maybe it would help, but it will also help large companies and probably be much more dangerous for us as the general public when large companies can coerce people, the Google, to remove links to things that they say are irrelevant, when in fact it is relevant if it happens to be in the public interest.
Does this cover corporate data? I may have misread it, but I thought it only covered personal data. Oh,
I don't know.
Well, even personal data, you mentioned UKIP are friendly anti-European overlords. some of their members have been saying one thing at the moment, and then you do a swift search on Twitter or Google, and then, oh, look, they've said something else in the past. It's great to look back and uncover what these people have said.
And there's a few sort of cases. I mean, one thing that I like about this legislation is it's not censorship. So it would still be there, and someone a journalist with the time could go through and dig it up. It just wouldn't necessarily pop up. And the other thing is the fact that they would have to show that it's assuming that the legislation was well-crafted, and they would actually have to show that it's irrelevant.
That's a big if.
It is a big if, but it'd be very hard, I think, for a politician to claim that their views on Europe ever became irrelevant and outdated.
Right.
Well, it depends on who's adjudicating on the decision, and
it's true.
The influence of the people involved.
That Tory who dressed up in Nazi uniform on a stag do, well, he wasn't representing his constituents. Well, one assumes, well dressed as a Nazi. But could he then argue that these pictures of him in Third Reich regalia were irrelevant?
He can argue it.
Lord Justice Everard.
He can argue whatever he wants. I think he would probably be wrong. I see this as, if it's done well, to protect people not in the public eye, not representing the public in that way. And that is why the irrelevant clause would be important for me.
So as we have to see how Google interprets this and how they enact it, and if they do at all.
Yeah, the Google's response, at least when I last saw it, was that they are disappointed and they are considering their options.
They're going to take the internet home with them.
Apple, we're going home. Which, sadly, it probably true. It is their internet, really.
Nice to go back to the days of web crawler and no Gmail.
Good old Activista.
Yeah.
What happened to you?
Yeah. That was perfect.
For searching the 1,000 sites that existed then.
I'd get my life back.
Right, more news. We've done that one. Novena, the open hardware laptop, reached its crowdfunding goal this fortnight. I don't even quite know how to describe it. They call it a laptop, but it's kind of not. It's kind of a box that folds up, and then you turn it around like a backwards laptop and have a keyboard, at least in the regular version. They also do a fancy version which does open up like a laptop in nice handcrafted wood and moleskin, I think. But that one's $5,000. So, I don't know. It looks wonderful, but you've got an ARM laptop for $5,000. Which, for some people, I'm sure they like that sort of thing. But it's a really interesting project because the whole thing is open, all the schematics. Obviously some of the chips aren't open because that would be just too much of a goal for now. So it's based on I think a Freescale quad core ARM chip and etc, and there's all the stuff, all the circuitry, whatever is there, and you can go and have a look at it, and there's lots of pretty coloured lines and drawings you can see and go, ooh, that's interesting.
This will presumably make it harder for the NSA and the Chinese government to spy on our hardware.
Probably, although if they've got stuff in chips and whatnot, maybe not. Who knows?
Who knows? We certainly don't know. Do we, listeners?
It'll probably make it a little bit harder for the NSA and the Chinese government to spy on what you're doing on your computer.
Mm-hmm. How much was the regular model then?
If memory serves, it was a little under $2,000 US, I think. It's expensive, but for
freedom isn't free.
Freedom isn't free. It's a small run. It's And
well, there's a Raspberry Pi laptop. You can. Did you see someone made one of those?
Yeah, there cool. were quite a few people have done them in various ways. But the whole point of this is the entire thing, other than the chips, is open. And the chips are as open as they can be. So he's always taken the openest option. So you can actually take it apart, see how it works all the way down to every level.
You don't expect the first prototype of anything to be cheap.
No.
I mean, the fact that it's at $2,000 is, you know, more affordable if you're fairly well off.
Yeah.
And then, you know, the next one will be cheaper and the next one will be cheaper.
Yeah. And it's got some really cool features as well. Like it's got an FPGA built in. Doing stuff.
FPGAs. You know what?
Awesome.
I've read something about FPGAs recently. What was it? Oh, I know. It was in Linux Voice.
Wow. That's amazing. Is there anything they don't cover?
Anyway, so this FPGAs thing, it's written by Ben Everard, and it shows you how to take a generic FPGA, which is it's like a chip, but you get to decide what switches go where. Is this right?
Roughly, yeah.
Rather than having to have your own factory and churning out a million chips, you can take this thing and program it and make it into a crunchy 8-bit sound chip.
Yeah. So a good way to think about it is you got a chip, and on there's like a load of logic gates and bits of memory and whatnot. And it stands for field programmable gate array, FPGA, and the field means out there, not in the factory.
In the field.
Yeah, as opposed like, to, I don't know, using a magnetic field.
Yeah.
And basically, you can design how the little individual components connect up. So in doing that, you can essentially design your own chips. So having this FPGA on there allows you to just add on whatever extra hardware you can come up with to design. For example, a really popular one for FPGAs used to be Bitcoin miners. So before the application-specific ICs, ASICs, became popular, FPGAs were actually very similar to ASICs, but you can do them one at a time rather than a million at a time.
So people were creating these massive arrays of Bitcoin mining things using FPGAs.
Yeah.
Why is that? Was that faster than using GPUs? Or
It certainly was initially, and then it probably always was. I mean, obviously, it depends on the GPU and the FPGA, and really right. What you're looking for is, in Bitcoin mining, is power efficiency.
Okay.
Buying the hardware is relatively cheap, but powering them is what costs the money. And because you can make it absolutely
right.
No overhead other than just the implementation of the Bitcoin miners. It worked out more efficient.
Right.
And that's only one trivial example. You can use it to emulate absolutely everything. For example, yeah, we did the 8-bit sound chips in Linux Voice, and you can implement separate processors in them. There's the ZPU, which you can use to sort of do Arduino type stuff. You can use it to implement an obscure network protocol hardware, anything really. And that's just one of the crazy things they've put into the Navina laptop. There's like a couple of Ethernet ports, so it's quite cool for pen testing. You can use it to sort of filter out stuff, pretend you're the NSA and listen in on what everyone's doing. Loads of cool stuff.
Sounds quite good.
That does sound quite awesome.
It's a proper sort of hackers for hackers laptop. You know, he's a hardware hacker and he's designed it for his own purposes, really.
What was the what was the total that they asked for?
The total they asked for was $250,000.
Wow!
And this morning it was up to 314.
Ooh,
good work!
Lots and lots of money. And more news. Ah, Chris Hadfield, you remember him for being in space playing guitar.
This is Major Tom.
As of Tuesday, that can no longer be listened to.
Oh no.
His copyright agreement has expired. It's been scrubbed from the internet. The internet have been scrubbed.
It's clean. A relevant search though.
You can search for it all you want. And you'll see all these news articles about how once you could listen to this song played in space.
That's sad.
Luckily Google doesn't control YouTube.
Yeah. That's quite fortunate. Let's have one little quick last item of news. The Chuck Norris grade cloud It's been released by Ubuntu. This may have been named by the very same Nick that should have been here today. We don't know.
He's probably, that's where he is now, isn't he? He's training Chuck Norris.
Yeah, maybe.
This is it's a privately hosted cloud from Ubuntu, so it's similar to sort of Elastic Cloud or whatever from Amazon, that sort of thing. You can rent a cloud. They charge $15 per host per day, and for that you get full support, whatnot, for your lovely Ubuntu cloud host thingy.
So this is a big new initiative for Canonical, isn't it, really?
Yeah.
I mean, a couple of months ago they stopped Ubuntu One, which is very much same technology on a completely different scale.
Maybe that's why they stopped Ubuntu One, so they had all these spare cloud machines floating around to do this with.
Or they didn't want to confuse... I mean, Ubuntu One, I assume, was hosted on somebody else's cloud.
I have no idea.
Or somebody else's back end. I don't know.
If only Nick were here.
Yes, if only Nick were here. Maybe he wouldn't be able to talk about it. I don't know. It's the kind of thing I imagine Ubuntu Canonical would get. You know, they want to control the information stream. But we know that Ubuntu is used by, as they say anyway, by 70% of OpenStack instances and providers. And we know that HP, Amazon, Google all use Ubuntu or Ubuntu-based distributions in their own cloud. So Canonical, I think, must want a piece of the action for itself, which is completely understandable.
Yeah, and it's an interesting way to go. I mean, they're obviously a commercial company looking for more ways to make money. And I mean, cloud hosting is becoming huge. And there's certainly a reason to go to them for it. They obviously know an awful lot about Ubuntu. Yeah. If you have any problems, they're the guys are going to be best place to fix it.
Yeah.
So, yeah, looks like an interesting option. Maybe they will finally turn a profit.
Maybe. Google have just massively reduced their prices, haven't they, which forced Amazon to do the same thing.
I mean, hosting in general, it always seems to be a race to the bottom.
Yeah, and that's what would worry me for Canonical's sake. I mean, if it's going to be a fight out between Google and Amazon, you know.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Is that the way to add value to your product then, offer Chuck Norris as a dancing butler?
I'm not sure you actually get Chuck Norris. I think it's just a name.
What?
And that's the news.
Fantastic news. I thought this podcast was going to be shorter than other podcasts. There's only the three of us. So that takes us on to discoveries, which may be a short section. Shall I go first? One of mine was actually the Razer Qt LXDE merge. I installed it on Arch, which seems to be one of the easier ways of getting it installed. There's a Manjaro Live CD if you want to try out the desktop, but there's very little to see. It's basically like cut down KDE for me. And in fact, the file manager is just a little bit too simple, so I end up using Dolphin, and then I might as well be using KDE. But if like me, you don't necessarily like the kind of the GTK based desktops, and I do need some low lightweight desktop environments sometimes for some of my installations, then I think it's a great alternative to KDE, which is hideously fat and ugly and memory intensive. So it looks really good.
Obviously, you can cut down the fat quite a lot on KDE if you try. Does it? Have you?
I haven't. I installed it. It would be good to do some comparison alongside. The thing is, I guess, KWin, the window manager in KDE, is probably what takes a lot of that.
Yeah.
So if you use a different window manager with this.
Yeah.
I imagine that's what's going to make the big difference, and you've still got a Qt environment, a Qt environment. I did have another discovery. Where's my? I emailed it myself. I must admit, I didn't actually try it, but it was a sync thing. Did you see this come up on Hacker News the last couple of days?
No.
It's an open source alternative to BitTorrent Sync, yes, and Dropbox.
They're quite different. I mean, which one is it more like?
I haven't installed it yet, so that's the caveat. But I think it looks more like BitTorrent Sync.
Yeah.
it looks super secure in the way that the keys are shared between clients. And I think it's got a feature that it's been a while since I used BitTorrent Sync. So BitTorrent Sync was a fantastic utility that shared your files across lots of different computers if you ran it on a server somewhere. It did it using the similar kind of peer-to-peer file transfers as BitTorrent. But it was never going to be clear whether it was going to become open source. And in fact, as a team here, we use OwnCloud's file syncing, which seems to work really well. At the last week of an issue, we're probably transferring tens or hundreds of megabytes during a day, all syncing files across, and it handles it okay. BitTorrent Sync seemed to be incredibly efficient when I used it. It performed much better than OwnCloud. SyncThing seems to do a similar thing, seems to be a similar kind of protocol. Also, it syncs across a LAN, so you don't need an internet connection, which is something I missed. So if I run SyncThing theoretically on my NAS box up here in the loft, for example, and I want a client here on my laptop, then it won't go through the internet.
Yes.
So I have to try it and tell you what it's like, but I like the idea. It's already open source. That was my other discovery.
I like the idea of things not going through the internet.
Yeah. Yeah, it seems inefficient to them. Yeah, if you're transferring files between...
Send it all the way to Cheltenham and then not all the way back here.
Yeah.
But then, how will GCHQ read it?
They're in the walls.
Yeah, that's
They're
okay.
Here.
Yeah.
They're here already.
Shall I go next?
Go for it.
I only have one discovery, and it's got nothing to do with Linux, but I shall say it anyway. Each Apollo rocket, the launch of it, you know, the taking up, designing, coming back down again, that took approximately the same amount of man hours to do as each pyramid in Egypt took to build.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Is there some kind of... symbolic number in the amount of effort and the amount of kind of the awesome things you achieve
are in the pyramid.
yes.
And when the carbon dioxide level rises too high for the ancient pharaohs to live here anymore, they will blast off
like the fifth element
in search of new life.
Yeah, that's my only discovery. That I guess the other thing I've discovered is if you talk about
you have not discovered anything. You have only found things.
Sorry, yes. The thing I found is that if you talk about shoelaces on a podcast, people send you photos of their shoelaces. And I'd love to help you, but I honestly can't tell from a photo of a shoelace which way it's tied up. But I guess thanks for the pictures.
That really hit a nerve, didn't it? That discovery, that find.
I found a few things. I found an old sewing machine in Mum and Dad's garage from 1889.
Like the single ones, which you put on your foot. And
yeah.
You're going to sell it to a local bar to use as a...
To a local Irish bar.
Yeah.
They could hang it from the ceiling.
Put it on top of a...
From their concrete ceiling. It had been to look authentic. Yeah, and now that's just taking up more space in the podcast room.
So you brought it back. What are you going to do with it?
I'm not going to do anything with it, am I? It's a sewing machine.
I used to live in Tanzania, and one thing I found quite interesting is you'd often see electric sewing machines retrofitted to be foot operated because the electric motors are just so awkward to keep working, obviously the electricity supply was erratic, but the foot ones are relatively easy to use.
Well, don't they still make?
Yeah,
they still make them.
They still make Singer sewing machines. I don't know if they're actually made by Singer or if they're...
No, well, I think they're made in different places, but they're probably, you know, licensed if anyone's bothered about from the original design.
Yeah.
I've read somewhere that they still sell many.
You used to be able to buy them new in the market in Tanzania.
That's cool. Yes, that's discovery number one. Not really a discovery. Another pseudo discovery.
Finds.
Oh. Hoisted by my own petard. Another find is that I've won an old Windows 7 laptop. Ooh. No, an old Vista laptop. So it, on first glance, it looks like it takes about 3 minutes to boot. I'm not sure how much of this is due to rust in the hard drive or anything, but we've had a, in the issue that we've just finished working on, of Linux Voice, that is, there's a tutorial in there about virtualizing an old Windows XP instance. So if you're scared of Trojans and viruses and all sorts of other things, but you desperately want to keep some of the applications that are on your old XP, you can virtualize that in a Linux host and merrily be virus-free and updated all the time using Linux, but still have your old copy of, I don't know, Manic Miner or whatever. whatever vitally important software that you need on Windows XP. So I'm thinking, when I get the time, i.e. never, I'm gonna put that old Windows instance on into VirtualBox and find out how quickly it boots in an actual controlled scientific environment compared with, I don't know, Linux Mint or something.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that'd be quite cool. And then people can accuse us of cheating and making it up. Just like last time when Graham did that.
Was it you? Oh, yeah, the great boot race.
Yeah.
Yeah. I never admitted to me actually doing it because it created such a massive flame war.
Oh, but sorry. We can believe.
God, yeah, that was hundreds of thousands of views on YouTube.
I'm trying to think. I have Windows 7 and Ubuntu on my desktop, and I think Ubuntu boots in about 7 seconds. I think Windows takes about 10. I have to get out my stopwatch.
That's still not bad. 10 seconds is acceptable.
I wouldn't cope with 11, but 10's all right.
That would be unacceptable.
Yes.
Other discovery is that the visual editor in WordPress is actually a lie. It's not what you see is what you get. It's what you see is kind of a bit what you get, but then kind of other bits are not quite right. So you don't know whether it's because it's a flaw in WordPress or that you've got the CSS wrong or whether you've missed an end tag off something. So what you end up doing is just scrapping it and doing it all again and then doing it all again and then realizing that it was WordPress's fault, not yours. And then you look up and then all of a sudden it's 5 o'clock and your day is gone. Never mind, eh?
I may be old-fashioned, but I don't think I've ever found a visual editor for anything that's been any good.
No.
Well, InDesign is good. That's a,
I suppose,
a visual editor.
Yeah.
But then it's only visual.
Yeah.
See, the problem we have is we do stuff that you can't do in the visual editor. So we do it in the code editor.
Uh-huh.
Whereas in InDesign, you don't have that option. If you can't do it in the visual editor, you can't do
it. I use InDesign on the command line.
Brilliant.
That's why I'm so leet.
Oh, yeah.
Those are my finds. England is still beautiful, by the way.
It's a beautiful day here. And the leaves have come out.
Yeah, I took a slight detour in the Midlands to look at an Eleanor Cross, which was nice.
The cucumbers are growing in the Morrison household.
Yeah.
Adorning every window.
Oh, before we finish finds of the fortnight, I think Mike sent in a couple of finds. So take it away, Mike.
Hello from Munich. I have one find this fortnight, and that's Levinux. This is a tiny version of Linux for education, as the author calls it. It's a variant of TinyCore Linux that boots up, downloads Python and Vim, and then gives you some pointers to get started. The idea is that there's very little extra clutter to complicate things, so you get this old-school short stack, as the developer calls it. So just a small stack of software. It tries to be a bit like the old 8-bit computers. You didn't think about libraries and toolkits and abstraction layers and stuff like that. You just turned the computer on, you had a prompt, and you started coding. What makes Levinux interesting is the way it's packaged. It's bundled as a disk image with the QEMU PC emulator for various platforms. So whether you're on a Linux, Mac, or Windows box, you just download it, double-click it, and start hacking straight away. There's no installation required or anything like that. The author claims you can even store it on a Dropbox account or server, so you have an ultra-portable mini Linux installation for doing some hacking everywhere. In that sense, it's sort of a bit like the Raspberry Pi. It's simple. There's not, you can just plug it in and go. And yeah, there are other things like this, but You don't have to download an ISO image and install VirtualBox and go through the whole installation. You can just give this to someone and say, double-click this, and then you'll start programming. I think one problem might be the choice of Vim as the default text editor, because Vim has such a giant learning curve, even though it's very awesome. It might be better with Nano or something like that, but it's very, very cool, and I recommend checking it out.
Excellent finds, Mike, whatever they were. Yeah, so Mike's emailed us. He said, I'm going to record these to make it fit together. It'd be good if one of you could say something like, Mike received a neuron from Phil the Sheep and sent in a recording. Take it away, Mike.
Yes, we've got two neurons from Phil the Sheep. Here's the first. He says, I was thinking about the TED talk that was mentioned in the last episode of the podcast. When I saw that, I was quite struck by the amount of things we probably do every day that we may be doing wrong. It's a good idea to step back every so often and look at the simple task you automatically do each day, whether in Linux or any other aspect of life, to see whether you're doing them correctly or efficiently. A simple example of this is bash aliases. I found that on my server, I was using ls-ltr a lot, so I created an lr alias for this, and it speeds up my day-to-day admin work more than you'd think, particularly with Linux. We've got a huge toolkit of shell functions and programs, scripting languages, etc., that we can call on to help us in our day-to-day tasks. So don't just stick with what you know. Use the opportunity to look at and learn new tools to expand your knowledge whilst helping you work. That's a very good point, Phil. And his second one, he says, I've noticed that Andrew Gregory seems to have become more and more hirsute as the project goes on. When he worked for Linux Format, he was always clean-shaven in the mag pictures. During the crowdfunding campaign, he had an amount of stubble. Now, after the magazine has been funded, he has a full and seemingly ever-growing beard. My question is, perish the thought, but if he ever leaves Linux Voice, will he turn into Captain Caveman? That's a good question, Phil. I'll leave Andrew to answer that one.
And at the end, I'll say, so Andrew, what's the deal with your facial hair? So Andrew can continue after that. Actually, somebody sent me a neuron as well. Just let me find it. So this is from Omniferous Implementer. He says, just to say, some time ago, you recommended a book called The Joy of X. Well, I bought it, read it, and loved it. I remember that was a couple of years ago in the old podcast. Yeah, it was. It wasn't just about statistics. It was about all kinds of mathematical stuff that I should have learnt at school but didn't. Omniferous says, let me return the favour, though you probably have read it, and I'm very late to the party. Ready Player One, an awesome book for past 80s micro users. Any book that mentions the Z80, Commodore 64, the TRS-80 must be worth reading. I haven't read it, but it sounds really good. Also, it may be a good section for the podcast book recommendations. Doesn't have to be directly Linux related, as we're all a bit techy anyway. Keep up the good work. Loving the Mag podcasts. I know you must be working very hard and it's appreciated. Just make sure the brew pie is working flat out. It is. Thanks, Omniferous.
I do actually have a book review. It's one I read quite recently, in fact reviewed for Linux Voice in one of the various issues. I forget which one. It may or may not be quite similar to The Joys of X. I haven't read that, but it's another statistics one. It's called The Signal and the Noise by Nate Silver. And it's talking about prediction, and it's a little bit hard to describe because it's not directly about how to use statistics to predict stuff. But it's kind of looking at where people do use statistics to try and predict stuff and why some areas work, some areas don't, the problems people have, the pitfalls, the success, etc. And it's actually really interesting because, you know, these, we might not think of them as that important, but in many ways they really are. I mean, economic forecasts can have a huge effect on, you know, the economy of the country, you know, good things sort of boys, and it can, and similarly with the weather forecasts, you know, we like to joke about how they're always wrong, but they do actually, you know, for some people they're really important economically, farmers, etc. For some people it just sort of depends whether or not they cycle to work or get the car or whatever. But anyway, yeah, I've completely digressed. It's a really good book, vaguely about statistics, more about prediction. Well worth a read.
That does sound good. That sounds like I would like to read it.
I can bring
it. We should have a book club.
Yeah, I can bring it over if you want.
Yeah, okay, yeah.
I'll swap it for The Joy of X.
I read a digital copy, but you can have that. It's probably not allowed, is it? No need. Kindle lets you do that, I think. It was a Kindle version, maybe.
I don't have a Kindle.
Kindle app on the Android works quite well.
That's true. I'm completely lost where we are now because...
I think it's the last bit.
Thanks, Mike. Thanks, Phil the Sheep. And I think I'm at maybe 20% of a Karl Marx. If you Google Trifon Ivanov, he was a Bulgarian defender in the 1994 World Cup. I'm approximately at his level.
I've just realised you're talking about your beard, aren't you?
Yeah.
I think you're talking about the colour of your shirt is 20% red.
Yeah, probably as well. Awesome. Synchronicity.
Not a bad album.
No. I have no idea what's going on.
That brings us to the pre-Voice of the Masses reminder that if you like the sound of this podcast, and of course you do because you've listened this long, you should probably think about subscribing to Linux Voice, which is our magazine. So go to shop.linuxvoice.com and have a look at the tempting array of subscription options available there. It comes with, if you buy a subscription, whether you get a digital subscription or a print subscription, it comes with access to the archives, to the back catalogue of stuff that we've produced. We didn't shout about that too much at first because there was nothing in the archive. But now there's
hundreds of pages.
Well, not only hundreds of pages, hundreds of thousands of words. We reckon that there are about 100,000 words per issue.
Yeah.
So there's, about 400,000 words of about Linux and tutorials and how to do stuff, how to get more out of Linux.
How many words in Lord of the Rings?
We did it once, didn't we? I think The Hobbit was about 110 or 120,000. I can Google it. So Lord of the Rings is a big book.
Yeah, that's true.
Heart of Darkness is only about 60,000 words.
But that's barely a pamphlet. It's about 80 pages, isn't it?
Barely a pamphlet. You cycled across Heart of Darkness.
Yeah. Yeah,
you cycled up the Congo.
Got a bit wet.
Okay, so a quick Google word count. It's 95,000 words in The Hobbit. And in fact, The Return of the King is 137,000 words. And in the entire Lord of the Rings, it's 481,000. So,
There's about Lord of the Rings.
About Lord of the Rings. But does The Lord of the Rings have a tutorial on John von Neumann?
I read it quite recently, and I don't recall that being in there.
And the Edvak machine.
No, again, I think he skipped over that.
Apparently he wrote the first computer virus.
Von Neumann?
Yeah.
Ah.
That's what...
Or Tolkien.
I don't know. Maybe Saruman. Fosspix, of course. Reviews of all sorts of great things.
We also might have more about the One Ring in...
probably, yes. <the next voice. laughs> So that's that attempt at promoting our magazine and making more money for us has been sabotaged by Ben wittering on about the Lord of the Rings, which brings us nicely to Voice of the Masses, in which we asked, what made you choose your current distro? Now, we used to have a policy of picking like yes or no things so that they could be easily summarised.
It used to be a ballot.
A ballot that was open. But now it's a voice in which you have more freedom. Freedom to express yourself and say what you want to say. You're not constricted by binary notions of yes and no.
It's just a test to stop computers answering. Computers could pass our previous Turing test, but they can't get this one.
So we've got a squillion responses, which is great. 65 responses. Let's start off with two of our writers who have contributed recently to Linux Voice. McNallu says, which is a nom de internet of Andrew Conway. He says, I was on the path to choose Debian, but my dad handed me a Slackware disk and said it was not bad. And Patrick Volkening was a capable, decent sort of chap. My dad's rather prone to understatements. I've been happily slacking ever since. You know what? Next issue, we should get Andrew to write something about Slackware.
Yeah.
It's a good idea.
Yeah. Maybe a comparison with some sort of shiny, gooey type. Ubuntu, maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a great idea. Look out for that. And Liam and Liam Dore, our games editor, says, Linux Mint Cinnamon for me, it simply offers the best features and performance I can find, not to mention their focus on ease of use. Hell, Clem and the team even implemented some of my ideas into it directly. Wow.
You mean he's not using SteamOS? Fire him!
He can't write words in SteamOS.
I'm trying hard enough then.
Brian Hunter says, I use Manjaro. It was recommended to me by Linux Voice's very own Liam Dore on the IRC channel. Oh, Liam's taking over. Matthew M says, I use Liam Dore X. No, he uses OpenSUSE, but he doesn't know why. Alejandro, I chose Ubuntu because it was easy to use. It's like your French GCSE, where if you get the answer right, then you get like a C. But if you can say because and then come up with some reason, then you get greater marks.
So I got a C in French GCSE.
I failed French.
Did you? And then chose to move there.
Yes. And then that's where he came back.
Nobody understood a word I was saying.
Corbin, I chose my current Mint because it was on a disc in a magazine written by some pretty cool guys.
Must have been a user developer.
Must have been. Yorkshire Tyke started off with Ubuntu 8.04 Hardy Heron after a Microsoft XP update stopped my dial-up internet connection from working. That's horrendous. That's not what updates are supposed to do.
My Linux updates have never done that.
Maybe Windows XP is going to get better now that Microsoft has stopped tinkering with it. Kevin O'Brien, I use Kubuntu and have for a number of years now. I prefer KDE to the desktops. I prefer Debian packaging to RPMs. And what distro better combines those two? Quite right. Which is something that we allude to in the forthcoming cover feature of Linux Voice Issue 4. We're looking at all the best Ubuntu respins. There is one out there for you. You might hate Unity or the lenses or other freedom-stealing features, but there's such a lot of awesome stuff in Ubuntu, and it's a shame to not use it just because of those. For example, Netrunner, used by Hugh. He says, as with any other distro I've used, my decision was based on it having a decent implementation of KDE and its particular set of bugs not being showstoppers for me. And Burgess Meredith says, Netrunner is a really nice KDE and underrated distro. So lots and lots of variety. What are you using, Graham?
Well, I've been using Arch for a while. We've spoken about it quite a lot, so I wasn't actually going to say. I think if you're writing about Linux and if you need to install, you know, Razer QT or whatever it happens to be, Arch is pretty much the only option because the user repository is just, I think, unparalleled. It's a great way of getting the very latest packages for everything. It's a really good distribution.
So how does it compare with something like Debian, which, you know, we always go on about it having a great range of applications and a lot of choice?
It's the main thing is the user repository is unsupported, but you can put, it's relatively straightforward to put packages together for Arch, and the package manager will build them for you from source. So the LXD Razer QT packages, for example, they pull all the source code from the GitHub repository and compile it and sort out all the dependencies. It's closer to Gen2 and Portage in that way. I don't think it's analogous to Debian at all. If you want to install a build environment and download the source code, it's probably the best way of getting close to an Arch experience. But at the same time, you don't get the same stability, and an upgrade can break the system and you need to tinker around with it. Manjaro is a really good alternative if you want to avoid that.
Is that the best of?
Well, Manjaro is Arch. It's built on Arch, so you get many of the same advantages. You can choose whatever desktop you want, but without the uncertainty.
Is that right?
Yeah.
I'm not interested in Bleeding Edge at all. In fact, I, sound a bit like Glenn Homer, who says, Slackware 1995, SUSE 1998, Ubuntu since 2008. Ubuntu provides the best balance between ease of use and functionality. I'll stick with it as long as I can use my beloved KDE instead of the abomination that is Unity.
Is it me, or is KDE getting more mentions these days?
It is,
because for quite a long time, we never heard anything about KDE other than me blathering on about it.
It is, but I think this is the way that the nationalist parties in the upcoming European elections threaten to split the votes. I think there are many, many, many parties, many desktops that are the non-complicated, ease-of-use, simple desktops. And then they sort of divide the votes, which makes it look as though KDE is more popular than maybe it is.
So does that mean if you're a socialist and you want to stop the national parties getting in, the best thing you can do is start a national party?
It's to do what Razor QT and LXDE have done and merge with your neighbours, the Popular People's Front of Socialism.
They're over there.
Thanks, Loretta. David says, I use Crunchban. Good man. Round of applause all around. I'd heard about it before, but decided to actually check it out when someone on the Linux Lifestyle podcast mentioned that the Crunchban forum was promoting the Linux Voice crowdfunding campaign. Turned out it had everything I wanted. Synaptic dev packages and next to no cruft whatsoever, and a big enough community to help me out where I went wrong. Yes.
Community is a very important part of it, actually. The Crunchban community are awesome.
And, yeah, and it also builds on Debian. Is it Debian or is it Ubuntu now?
Always used to be Debian.
Yeah, I think it's Debian. And that's part of the reason, in fact. A few people mentioned that we had Crunchban on the issue one campaign cover. Wasn't in issue one when we eventually did it, but that's because it's so seldom updated. I mean, Core Nominal himself says, you know, it's difficult when there's only going to be an update when there's a Debian update. It doesn't create the same kind of noise that other distributions do, and which is why it's great to bring it up and remind people that it exists.
It's out there.
Yeah.
And it's brilliant. I think I sort of use the one that's least hassle. If there's any hassle at all involved in changing, then I won't bother to change. So I've had Mint, I think it's Mint 13 now for ages, the Cinnamon version. Even though Cinnamon's moved on quite a lot since then, I just still feel no need to upgrade at all. I did have SUSE for a long time, but then I was perfectly happy with that, but then they signed that evil deal with Blue Systems. I shunned them, and then Ubuntu, and then but this was in the early days of Unity, so it just wasn't working quite right. Now, I'm sure if they'd rolled Unity out when it was actually functional, not in a late beta, then I'd still be with Ubuntu now, because I just can't get on with RPMs and the Fedora Red Hat way of doing things. I don't really like it at all.
Yeah, but actually, a word of caution on Mint updates. My dad's just updated from Mint 14 to Mint 16, and it's broken his computer.
Best not to update then.
Yeah, stay away from those. It's one of those things I get a phone call saying, you know, it's crashed. How do you fix it? And I know my dad listens to this podcast, so I'm not being condescending, but it's really hard to diagnose a problem from that. It's like there'll be the window manager. I assume it's Cinnamon. Did we have Cinnamon on the DVD in issue one?
Probably.
I think it was a Cinnamon version. Yeah, that's causing his screen to freeze up, and I have no idea why.
Right, yep. Yeah. That's what Rodville says. I'm using Mint with Cinnamon because it's what works better in my laptop and for myself. Fine. It's not about pointless choice, it's about choosing things because they work best. Are you still using Ubuntu then?
I am. I'm using the wrong version of Ubuntu at the moment. I'm using 12.04 32-bit. Because I DD'd the wrong image onto a USB stick when I was installing it. And I didn't realise until, I've been using it for a while, and I was in Lee Roth's office, and I was like, oh, how many words? Hey, obviously word counts are important when we're writing. And I thought, hang on, it should be in the bottom bar, the status bar. It wasn't. I was like, what? A really old version? Because I think it should have been 1310 at that point. I thought, I can't have that old a version of LibreOffice. Then I realised my mistake. And I haven't got around to updating it yet. I keep meaning to. There's even space on the hard drive for another one, so I don't even have to try and work out how to back up my data. But
because backing up your data is such a massive hassle, isn't it?
Well, all my
backs up, really.
I back up all my work, my writing. That's on the backup server.
It's printed.
Yeah, it's all printed. Just OCR the copies. Yeah, no, I should go. I keep meaning to go to 1404 and haven't yet got around to it. But I run Lubuntu. I've just installed Lubuntu on my laptop and quite happy with it so far. It's a bit of a shame they're going to Qt. I quite like the GTK2 version.
Well, if you're looking for a new distro, and hopefully we've given you some suggestions, but if your thirst is as yet unslaked, I would recommend going to linuxvoice.com and reading through some of the comments, because everyone's got a reason. There's no fanboy nonsense like, because it's the best.
There was the guy who said OpenSUSE and he doesn't know why.
Yeah. Well, but maybe because OpenSUSE produces feelings of euphoric forgetfulness.
Maybe.
Could be that.
I always like the way, I don't know if they still do, but when it booted up, it used to say, have a lot of fun.
Yeah. Great. I'm going to Dizzy Lizzie. Good to have you with us, Dizzy Lizzie, old listener from ye olden days. Debian. Debian's free software, and with only the cleanly separated main repository enabled, I'm cruising in a silicon space cruiser of freedom. I'm going to leave you with that now, but do go and read through more comments, because there's such a range of winners. Manjaro comes out strongly, as does Arch, as does Ubuntu, Kubuntu,
Netrunner.
Yeah. So yeah, have a look. It's great. Thanks to everybody who contributed to that really clever, intelligent corner of the internet.
So that's it then, the three of us. We've made it through about an hour's worth of podcast. Hopefully we'll have Mike next time.
I hope so.
Even if Andrew's dialing in remotely. Which works all right.
So that's it. Maybe that should be the next voice of the masses. Do you want to listen to Mike anymore? Leathering is nonsense.
Maybe we should make him dial in from Mike-os.
Ask your art, Mike. Or we just read out what he says on the IRC channel. Right.
Oh, I've got one more thing.
Oh, wow.
I know, it's crazy, isn't it? Linux Voice is now available in Barnes & Noble in the USA. From sea to shining sea, our manifest destiny has spread us across 660 Barnes & Noble stores. So I would say there's one near you, but it's probably a really long drive to get anywhere over there. But if you live near Barnes & Noble and you want to buy Linux Voice, have a look in there, because that's where it'll be.
Excellent. See you in 2 weeks.
Bye.
Bye.